I'm Gloria and I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me okay? I'm cross-eyed looking at this thing. I want to thank Tim and Renee and all the rest of you who have anything to do with putting this together for having us up here. Our room is great, and the flowers were beautiful, and the food basket, everything has been very nice. You've been very warm and loving to us since we've been here, and we appreciate it. When I go to different places, whether I'm in an AA thing or just in a different place, I always like to try to, I'm always sensitive to the way it feels there, and I feel a very sweet, loving environment here. You guys, you just feel good and feel gentle and warm and sweet, like an AA convention should feel. And so I can see why you like it. I'm not crazy about rattlesnakes and camping, however. I'm glad I'm at the pepper tree. The food was great. Everything's great. I'm glad to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. And I have been glad to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous ever since I first got here. I'm not one of those people that came to AA and got sober and hated it or had a hard time relating to the people or any of that. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning. I'm one of those people that believe that I was born alcoholic. My parents were alcoholic, and they both died from alcoholism. My father died from alcoholism when I was 6, and my mother married another alcoholic not too long after that. And so I knew about drinking, I knew about the things that go on in an alcoholic home. What I didn't know was that the people that lived there were sick. I thought they were bad, and I thought that I was somehow bad and partly responsible for the things that went on in that house. And I'm one of those people that just seem to have been born guilty. I just felt guilty from as far back as I can remember. I always felt afraid, and I always felt ashamed. Those are my earliest memories of the way that I felt. I never felt like I was as good as other people. I just didn't seem to fit in. I was an only child, and I just sort of was a loner. I just sort of was by myself most of the time. There weren't a lot of little kids in my neighborhood. And I was in fantasy a lot. And I believe that when alcohol came my way, I was ready. All I needed to set up the disease of alcoholism was a drink of alcohol. And that's just the way that it worked for me. When I was 13 years old, I was at a cafe on Christmas Eve drinking Cokes and talking to the old man who owned the place. I used to spend a lot of time down there. My stepfather was real violent, and a lot of stuff went on in my house, and so I used to try to stay out of the house until he was passed out at night. And so a lot of nights I stayed down at this cafe. And this is where I was this particular Christmas Eve. And I was there by myself, and some guys came along that I knew. By this time, I hated girls. I hated what I thought they were and what I thought I wasn't, and I didn't think that I could ever be what they were, so I hung around the boys. And some boys came along that I knew, and I went for a ride with them, and they started drinking, and I started drinking with them. I don't remember any big decision, you know, or thinking this is good or bad or right or wrong. I just simply started to drink. It just seemed perfectly natural. And I don't know how many I had that night before I began to experience a feeling that was to keep me in bondage for the next 16 years of my life. I just had a feeling that night that I could be anybody I wanted to be. It allowed me to be somebody other than who I thought I was. And I just didn't care. I didn't care if it was Christmas. I didn't care if my mother was home getting beat up. I just didn't care if I was bad and crazy and wild. I just didn't care. And the next day I woke up and I was in a strange town in an abandoned car. I was by myself and I was scared to death and I was more ashamed than I'd ever been in my life. And I know that I knew that morning that I had found something that I didn't want to let go of, and I became willing to pay any price to experience that feeling. My obsession from that time on was to just find something to put inside me so that I didn't have to think or feel or care. Not too long after that, I started using drugs. I just ran the streets. I ran around with people older than I was, and I very seldom ever went to school after that. And I didn't do anything positive with my life at all. All I wanted to do was hang around what I thought to be gangsters. I was kind of, they were sort of my idols. I'd been to a lot of movies, and the gangsters were always the ones that I liked. And these boys that I hung out with were about 13, 14 years old, and I thought they were gangsters. They stole hubcaps and wore leather jackets. And I thought they were these big deal gangsters, but little by little I began to hang out with older ones, and they were running around doing things that I thought were real exciting. And I'd run away from home a lot, and I'd go to juvenile hall a lot, and get arrested, I was on probation a lot, and I thought that gave me something to be, I could get just as much attention by shocking people as I could by being good, and I thought that gave me some kind of an image that made me somebody. And so I wasn't ashamed of those things. What I was ashamed of were the feelings that I had inside and who I thought I was, how bad I thought I was. And when I was 15 years old, I married an older man. He was 19 and I was 15. And we were going to live happily ever after. I'd been seeing him for a while. He was a longshoreman. He lived in Wilmington. And he'd take me to all those waterfront bars, and we'd run around having a good time. And those were the kinds of places that I was most comfortable in just the sleaziest, run-down waterfront bar where everybody was just wild and crazy. And then I thought what I was didn't show so badly. I didn't stand out so much. And so I was perfectly comfortable in places like that, and I looked older than I was, and so I got along just fine in those places. Trouble was, as soon as we got married, he wanted me to stay home and be Susie Homemaker, and he would continue going out having all this fun, and I didn't like that idea, but I went along with it because I didn't have any place else to go. So we were married almost 3 years, and I just got 3 years sicker. I drank as often as I could, and when I'd run away from home, I would just stay drunk and stay gone as long as I could, and then I'd come home. And towards the end of the marriage, we had a son, and one day I just picked him up and walked out and never went back. I was living at my mother's house, and I thought of an old friend of mine who was one of these boys that I'd known and run around with since I was 11 years old. We'd always been good friends. And I went over to see him, and he was glad to see me, and I was glad to see him, and we had a good time that night, and we started seeing each other every night, and we thought we were lucky because we'd both been married before, and neither one of us ever wanted to get married again. And after about 5 months, we decided to get married. He hopped his fishing pole for money for a marriage license, and we started out. That was our financial inventory at the time. It never got any better, believe me, until we got sober. We started having children. We had a son, and then we had a daughter. So now I have 3 children, and I'm completely incapable of taking care of myself, let alone taking care of any children. I didn't know how to be a wife, let alone a mother. And the guilt would drive me, and sobriety became impossible for me. I couldn't take care of these kids, and my obsession was always to just get out in the bars. I was always, when I first got sober, I heard somebody say I was either getting ready for a drunk or coming off of a drunk. And that's the way that I lived. Everything in my life revolved around getting out to these bars and getting out to seeing these people and getting drunk. I was never a home drunk. I was never one of those housewives that just does the ironing and kind of sits along and peers out of the drawn drape. That wasn't my experience. I used to wish to God I could stay home and drink in the house, but I never was able to do that. I'm a runner, and when I drink, I'm completely out of control. Anyway, I never took care of these children, and I didn't do anything right. I just simply didn't do anything right. I'd go out and drink on binges. It would be too much to handle, so I'd just stay gone from the house for days at a time. And my shame and my guilt were constantly with me. I hated myself. I hated the kind of mother I was. I hated the kind of wife I was. I hated everything. I hated life, and I just wanted out. And alcohol was the only thing that took me out. I am a blackout drunk. And up until the very end, alcohol worked for me. I could just black out the world. I could just go into oblivion, and that was it. An old-timer used to speak around a lot that's dead now. Used to talk about just going into a bus station and just saying, give me a ticket to nowhere. And that's what I wanted, was just a ticket to nowhere. I just wanted oblivion. Everything I ever took was just for me to just, I just wanted to get out of life. I never tried to get into life. I never drank to be the life of the party or function on a job, because I very seldom ever worked at anything. I just didn't want in. I wanted out. Anyway, I ended up leaving these kids with my mother-in-law for the weekend. It turned out to be over 2 years before I ever went back for my children. I just abandoned my children. And my husband and I ended up driving around California and Oregon on Greyhound buses, living in rescue missions and Salvation Armies and wino hotels. I know what it's like to sell my blood for a drink. I know what it's like to be walking down the street in a strange town just in filthy, dirty clothes, just a wino is all I was. Standing in front of liquor stores at 6 o'clock in the morning, waiting for them to open the door so we could go in and get a drink. And I never want to have to live that way again. I never want to have to experience that kind of humiliation and that kind of shame, sitting on bus benches wondering where I'd been and where I was going. And they say there's a price to pay to get here. And there's also a price to pay to stay here. And I am willing, more willing than I've ever been in my life. The willingness, thank God, seems to grow within me. The longer I stay sober, the more I know that I'm alcoholic, the more I know that I don't want to ever go back and live the way that I was living. That knowledge becomes deeper and deeper and deeper the longer that I stay sober. And I'm willing to do whatever I have to do today to protect my feet in Alcoholics Anonymous, to protect my sobriety. Eventually we came back to town and he ended up going to jail for 6 months, and so I was on my own, and I ended up running around with some people that were robbing stores and using heroin, and I just started doing that with them. And before long, I found myself driving the car for these robberies night after night, and finally got arrested. And they kept me in jail for a couple of days, and then they let me go because I just drove the car. They didn't have enough evidence to hold me. And so the night that I got out, I didn't have anywhere to go. I'd been staying in this little hotel room, and they had locked that up, and I didn't have anybody to contact. All the people that would have anything to do with me were in jail. And so I thought of my first husband, and I called him, and I told him that I was in trouble and needed a place to stay, and he said that I could come over if I didn't cause any trouble. And I just thought, you know, it takes a lot of nerve for him to say something like that to me, since this was all his fault. I always had somebody to blame. Never did learn to take responsibility for my own actions until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God the people that I ran into from the very beginning were not afraid to tell me the truth. They weren't scared of running me back out. They weren't afraid that I'd get drunk if I heard the truth. They knew that the truth was the only thing that was going to save my life. And they weren't afraid to talk to me about God. They weren't afraid of scaring me off. Somebody told me that God doesn't live in the shadows. God lives out in the light. God lives where the truth is. And that I must learn what the truth about myself is, and I must always learn to follow that truth, whatever my own truth is, not what your truth is, but what my truth is. They told me that God would reveal that to me if I would practice the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very grateful for those people today, because it becomes more and more important to me to follow my own truth. It's the only way that I've ever found a peace. And the people that told me that I would find peace within myself and freedom if I would learn to take responsibility for my own actions didn't lie to me. It's a wonderful thing to be able to see my part in any kind of a problem situation and do what I can do about it because of through the use of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and then just close the door on it and walk on. I don't have to be bound to anybody today, chained to anybody because of my hatred and my resentment for them. And as long as I'm blaming you for something, I'm going to hate you and resent you. They told me I could just take the word blame out of my vocabulary. And so I'm pretty much free today. I don't have any resentment or any hatred towards any person, place, or thing. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's about all I have going for me. Those were the only emotions that I felt, and I didn't even know it. I didn't even know that I felt those things. I remember telling my sponsor right away that I was very lucky that I wasn't one of those people that was full of hate. And she just patted me on the shoulder and said, "Oh, that's nice, honey." So that's what she used to do. Knowing that I was going to find out soon enough for myself all of these things. I went over there, and I don't know how long I was there. I don't know much about what happened, except I know that the thing happened to me that I believe happens to every alcoholic who's given the gift of sobriety, and that was that it just simply didn't work for me anymore. No matter how much I drank, it didn't give me that oblivion anymore. It didn't take away the fear or the shame or the guilt. And he said he'd send me to Harbor General Hospital in a cab, and then that would be all he could do for me. So that's the way it had to end up for me. I ended up riding up to a county hospital in a taxi cab alone to die. I thought I was going there to die. My mother had died of alcoholism in that hospital a few years before that. And I just was sure that I was going there to do the same thing. I sit in the waiting room of Harbor General Hospital, and I was 29 years old, and I was bright yellow. I had on a pair of Nan's Levi's, a pair of Levi's and a Nan's shirt, and I didn't even have an address to put down on the admitting form. And they put me in a room, and the doctors came around, and they did a biopsy on my liver. And the doctors came and told me that the results showed that my liver was so badly damaged that I wouldn't live over 5 years if I, 3 years if I kept on going the way I was going. I wouldn't live over five if I didn't drink again. So I laid there awake that night thinking about dying, and I always thought that's what I wanted. I thought I wanted out, and I look back on it now, and I know that it was just more self-pity. Because when it got right down to it, I remembered what my grandmother had told me happens to people like me when they die, and I was scared to death. I was desperate because I knew that I deserved the very worst. And so I started talking to God that night, and that was the last thing I wanted to do. The last thing I had on my mind was talking to God. It had been a long time since I wanted to have anything to do with Him. When I was a child, I had a strong faith in God, and I wasn't afraid of Him at all. I knew He loved me when I was a little child, a very young child. And somehow that all sort of went away, and at that point, I just knew that I just couldn't ask God for anything, because if I got His attention on me, I was going to get what I deserved. But that night I was so desperate, I asked Him for one thing, and that was to just please let me live. I just simply wanted to keep on breathing. And I had what I believe to have been a spiritual experience that night. It wasn't the result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just an experience of a very loving God showing me some truth about myself and giving me an ability to see it, maybe for the first time in my life. I have since had many spiritual experiences in this program as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that every member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's working the program has spiritual experiences frequently. But we just don't always know it. I kind of believe we're angels with amnesia. And we've got a lot of things going for us. We just don't know it. And when we find out, when we have some new awareness about how to live, some new awareness about the program, when we're reading the 12 and 12 or the big book, and all of a sudden we think, hey, that's right, that's right. That's a spiritual experience as far as I'm concerned. The next morning the doctor came to my room, and he said, he had a big smile on his face, and he said, "Well, you're not going to die." He said, "Shows you how much we know about the human liver. We just made a mistake," and he just was all cheerful and happy. And I said, "God, I spent my night reforming, and this guy's made a mistake." Today, I know it wasn't a mistake. I know that God doesn't make mistakes, and I believe it was just His hand bringing me a little bit closer to the program, a little bit closer to a place where I could surrender. And they moved me to another hospital, and I started going to AA meetings there. And I don't know much of what was said in those early meetings. I just know the way that it felt. And I can tell you that I kept going back to AA meetings for the same reason that I kept going back to alcohol and drugs, because I liked the way that it felt. It just felt gentle and soft and safe. And that same sweet spirit was in that room, in those rooms, in those meetings in El Cerrito Hospital in Long Beach, that I feel here tonight. And that I feel in most every Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that I go to. The people of Alcoholics Anonymous started loving me well. That's exactly what happened to me. I had no power. The book tells me that lack of power was my dilemma. And I had no power of my own. I had no knowledge of where to find the power to live by. I didn't know how to live. And the people in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, before the meetings, during the meetings, and after the meetings, just kept telling me to just keep coming back, just put one foot in front of the other, and that I would come along. I would learn how to work this program, how to live this program, how to apply its principles to my life. And that's what's happened for me. I ended up leaving that hospital and going to a woman's recovery house, and I began to study the book Alcoholics Anonymous every morning. We did that every morning. And I got acquainted with a lot of the women in Long Beach. And I began to watch the way that they lived their life, the way that they talked, the way that they dressed. And I knew that if I was going to stay sober, that I sure couldn't live the way that I'd been living. I didn't want to live the way that I'd been living. I knew I was going to have to change everything about me, the way that I dressed myself, the way that I talked. My whole motivation in life was going to have to change. And so I tried to be like what these women were. I just idolized these women. And the most important thing that I saw about them was the way that they carried themselves. They didn't seem to be ashamed of themselves. They shared with all of us in the house the things, the places they'd been and the things they'd done, and I could see very clearly that they weren't ashamed anymore. And they told me that I didn't have to be ashamed anymore. And they told me I'd never have to go back out and live the way that I'd been living if I didn't want to. And that's the truth. And I can tell those of you who are new here tonight, or those of you who are maybe been here a while and you still haven't experienced that freedom from shame, and you still can't figure out how to not live the way that you were living on the streets as an alcoholic woman, I can tell you, you don't have to live that way anymore. You don't have to live that way anymore. You don't have to pay for your place in this world anymore. God created every one of us. You've been touched by the hand of God, or you wouldn't be sitting here. And I believe that He brought us all in here. And somebody told me when I was new that the minute we walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous that we're ladies. And he said that if you'll act like a lady, if you'll conduct yourself like a lady, you'll be treated like a lady. And that's been true. And I'm free from shame today. I feel clean inside, and most days I feel that way. Most of the time, I feel this sense of being centered and being belonging in the world, and I sure didn't feel that way before I got to this program. I never belonged anywhere. My husband came home from jail, and we got a little apartment in the alley behind the House of Hope. They said don't get too far away, so we didn't get too far away. And we started going to AA meetings, and we've been going to AA meetings together ever since. Last Wednesday we celebrated 32 years of marriage, and that's... Don't clap for that. believe me, that's the grace of God working in our lives. Obviously, we've done everything there is to do. Both of us drink during our drinking together. We've done everything there is to do to each other, and it's just because of Alcoholics Anonymous that we're still together today. And still love each other. I love my husband very much today, and I seem to love him more as time goes on. And we were friends for a long time before we ever got married. He's known me since I was 11 years old, and so you know, life is very good. It's a very special blessing that God's given us to be able to live our life and share sobriety today. We were about 8 months sober. We got our kids home, I started trying to learn how to be a mother. And as in everything else, they told me that if I would keep my number one problem first, keep Alcoholics Anonymous first in my life, that everything else would come along. And that's what I've tried to do. I'm grateful that none of the women in AA told me that I was going to have to join the PTA and be the perfect housewife and the perfect mother and learn how to organize recipes and all that kind of stuff. They told me I was going to have to go to jail panels and hospital panels and talk to women drunks and take people to meetings and do this and do that. And if I do that, then I'd know how to be a mother at home. And, you know, that doesn't make a real lot of sense. But it does make sense to me today, and it makes sense to those of us who've tried it. I am an alcoholic, and if it wouldn't have been for me using the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, my children wouldn't have any mother at all. And so I'm very grateful for the information that I was given. All three of my children turned out to be alcoholics, and they all had drug problems. And I know that there's lots of people in this room that are probably going through the same experience of having your children out there doing whatever. And I know the pain that's in your heart. I know about the sleepless nights, laying awake, worrying about them, wondering if they're going to be dead or alive, wondering if you're going to get a phone call, and all of that sort of thing. And I know about thinking that it was my fault. I know about the guilt that came back, and the guilt of all of that went away the same way that it did the first time, and every time that I've used the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to clean away the wreckage of my past. I came to find out that it was not that I'm not responsible for my children's alcoholism, but I did know, I did find out, I was told that I contributed to their sickness, and that made sense to me. I mean, any idiot would know that I had had some kind of contribution in my children's lives to the problems that they had, but they pointed out the things that I could do about that, and I did it, and then I closed the door and walked on, as we did with everything else in our lives. And so for me today, I'm free of all that. I don't have a lot of time tonight, so I'm not going to go into a whole lot of things, but I just, you know, there's always one thing that's most important in my mind to try to pass on in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting when I'm asked to share. I'm so aware of the pain that we carry around inside of us in sobriety, sitting in meetings, even though we're laughing. You know, like Norm Alpha used to say, we laugh when we're sad and we cry when we're happy, and we call it Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I went many years, and I still go right now today. You know, I'm out laughing and having a good time in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but my heart, it hurts, and I have pain inside sometimes over various things, and I know all of you do too. And you know, they say the joy of living is a theme of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I always am most concerned with is I just want to pass on a message of hope to anybody who doesn't have that joy, who just thinks all you've got is pain and that's all you can have. Don't wait until they get sober to get joyful and experience the joy that you can have in your life. Don't wait till they get well. Don't wait till they till everything shapes up before you begin to allow yourself to experience the joy that this program will give you. Because I'm here to tell you through my own experience that it doesn't matter what's going on in your life, you can experience the joy that Alcoholics Anonymous has to bring you. And the way to do that is to live these 12 steps on a daily basis, to stay active and stay involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, regardless of what's going on in your life. For the last 2 years of my sobriety, I haven't been able to get out to meetings like I used to. Bob and I moved to the desert, and 2 years ago our son moved in with us, and he was sick. And we had to stay in the house most of the time and take care of him. But I was very grateful for the opportunity to do that, believe me, because the way that he grew up and the way that I lived and the way that I treated him, it would be a long shot for him to ever want to come home and have me take care of him in his last days. But by that time, he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and AA, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, had healed our relationship and had given us a great love for each other, something that probably wouldn't have been possible. I know it wouldn't have been possible without the program. And so Bob and I made a commitment to ourselves and to him that we would take care of him until the end. And that's what we did. We said we were going to take him out in style, and we did. He had anything he needed or wanted, and he was very comfortable, and he had AA meetings in the house, and he had AAs coming to him all the time. And the hope that I want to pass on tonight, the message that I want to pass on tonight, that is, it seems to be the most important thing. It seems to be something that, I mean, I can't give a talk without saying it. I know it's something that God wants me to pass on, is that this boy who was on his deathbed, maybe 2 weeks before he died, we had a little meeting in the house, and he shared that nothing he'd been asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous was too much for him. That it had never been a chore. There wasn't any job that he had been asked to do that was ever too much. And that Alcoholics Anonymous had given him his life. And I want to always carry that message. That was his message. And it's also my message. And I hope that I'm always available to carry that message. Because without this program, I wouldn't have any life at all. And I certainly wouldn't have experienced the joy that I've experienced. And I certainly wouldn't have been able to live in sobriety and experience the pain that I've experienced, and wouldn't get the opportunity to see new people arrive and sick and hopeless, and see them fill up with hope and see them sober up and live their lives and see life come together for them. So I just want to pass that on tonight. If any of you are sitting there and you think you're hopeless and you think you're never going to get joyful again, don't believe it. You can be joyful tonight. You know, just as soon as you want to, you can experience the joy that Alcoholics Anonymous has to give you. When I was new, I used to shop in junk stores a lot, and one day I found a little wooden plaque, and I don't know what it meant to the person that threw it away, but I know it's very important to me. I've had it hanging in my house ever since I found it. It's got some keys painted on it, and it says the keys to the kingdom. And it reminds me of that place in the book that says now there's a sense of belonging, of being wanted, needed, and loved. In return for a hangover and a bottle, I've been given the keys to the kingdom. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Gloria. Let's give her another hand. Now we get to hear from Bob.
Hi, I'm Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. And my wife and I are very grateful to be asked to come here and share our story. I'm very, very grateful in my heart about Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a totally new life, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's a way of life. I feel when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was as good an example of self-will run riot that I know. Now, looking up at me here today, I might look like a librarian or a banker or something, but believe me, I didn't quite look like this. Well, I might have, but I just didn't have these kind of clothes on, I guess. my life before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was a pure living hell, and that's just the best way I can describe it. I was living in hell before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I lived in downtown Long Beach with my mother, who was a drunk, and I had an older brother that lived there with us. He was like 10 years older than me. So it was almost like I didn't have a brother. It was kind of like a father figure, only he didn't do that part of it. My brother was a gambler, and to tell you how we lived, it was this kind of a dog-eat-dog situation. My mother was hustling my brother for money to drink with, and my brother was hustling my mother for money to gamble with, and I got real smart as a young kid, and I'd get up early in the morning and raffle my mother's purse. I guess they called it self-survival then. Well, I learned to live on a self-survival basis until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I became my own god. I lived the only way I thought I could live, which is a survival basis, which meant that everything was living for me, and it didn't make any difference who I hurt or you know, who whatever loved ones were around me or whatever. I came first, and that was just the way it was, and I was okay until you found out about me, and then you know, once you knew about me, well, then you didn't want me around. And so therefore I got ran off a lot. But I don't have a lot of time to tell you everything, but I can tell you that I had a little friend that I used to go over to his house and usually be around dinner time when I'd show up over there, hang around over there, because his mother had always cooked dinner. My mother was a drunk. She was always at the corner bar, you know. So I got real smart and would always be over there about dinner time. And his mother would always say, "Bob, would you like to have dinner with us?" And I'd say, "Oh, I guess, you know." You know, but there was, we'd have dinner and lay around and watch TV or whatever. And what I liked about it is there was something was in that home that I didn't have in my house. And there was, you know, there was a feeling of love and caring. And it wasn't that my mother didn't love me. My mother was a drunk. You know, she was doing her deal. So whatever was in this house, I wanted it. And I remember having a lot of thoughts when I was young that, you know, the apartment building we lived in, there was prostitution going on in there. And, you know, just a lot of things. It was right downtown Long Beach in the city. And so I used to see a lot of things going on and a lot of dirty things. And I always knew that when I grew up and I could have control of my life, that things weren't going to be that way for me. You know, I'd see men come in suits and go at these prostitutes, and they were probably married men. And it just seemed like everybody had a selling out price, and I just didn't want that in my life. And, you know, being over at this friend's house and having those good feelings and having things decent, I'd get on my bicycle and ride home, and I had the feeling that if I could just live to get old enough to grow up, I'd be okay. And I'd get on this bicycle and ride home, and the fear would grip me. And when I got home, my mother would be there, and if she was drinking, sometimes she was kind of violent. She'd bang me around, or worse yet, I'd get at home and nobody would be there. And that used to just terrify me. As a young kid, I spent many, many nights in this in this apartment building, just scared to death, knowing that somebody's going to come through this door and get me, or, you know, I'd lay in bed and cover up my head and it was like a monster or something. You know, I just used to have weird thoughts. A lot of times I'd hear footsteps out the door and stand there with a butcher knife, and I was just terrified as a kid. And anyway, as time went on, I started dating different girls, and every girl that I'd go with when I was like 11 and 12, 13 years old, I'd fall madly in love with. And I thought, gosh, you know, if we can just stay together and long enough and get, you know, to when we can get married, that everything will be okay. And when I was about 14, I was going with when I was 15, I was going with a girl that was 13. And we decided that we'd get married. We found out that you could go to Utah and legally get married when the boy was 16 and the girl was 14. So we held out till we made our birthdays, and we got on the Greyhound bus and went to St. George, Utah, and got married. And I knew everything was going to be okay. We got this little apartment, and we both quit school. And I got a job, and I'd go to work in the daytime, and she'd go to her mother's house. And this went on for about 10 or 11 months. You know, I'd go to work, she'd go to her mother's. One day I came home from work after about 11 months. She wasn't at home, and, you know, I never went looking for her again. In fact, I've never seen her to this day, you know. Kind of realized how sick I was after I was in AA for a while. That, you know, most guys are out, you know, gunned down their wife, you know, who she with or what she doing, and she didn't come home, and I just said, well, heck with her, you know. So anyway, I moved back with my mother, and by this time my brother had gotten married, and my mother was still drinking, and I started running around with my old buddies. One of them was that friend that I used to be with all the time, and a couple of my other friends. And by this time, they were riding around in lowered cars, drinking and smoking dope and dropping pills. And it wasn't long before I joined in doing that with them. You know, I can just tell you one incident of being on a Pacific Coast Highway in Long Beach, sitting in this 55 Lord Buick with my righteous partner, smoking a little weed, and had just dropped a couple of bennies and maybe taken a red or something, you know, and just everything was working at 100%, you know. Looking, being at this stop sign, I remember looking over at the car, and the car next to us, there was a little old couple in there, and I thought, man, these lame people don't know what we got in this car. I hope when we're 40 or 50 years old that we can all stay together and just keep doing this, you know. And that's what alcohol did for me, you know, the combination of drinking and whatever it may have been. It could have been tripping high-grade cough syrup or acid or whatever, you know. I was the kind of person that never had any money, and so whatever you had, that was good with me. I like it, you know. I wasn't choosy, you know. I'm the kind of a sneak, cheat, person that was so, well, you know, if you give me a can of weed to roll up, well, you know, as soon as you turn your back, I'd stick it right in my pocket, you know, a whole bunch of it, just grab the seeds and everything, you know, I mean, but that's the kind of person I was. That's the way I operated before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was the kind of drunk, my mother wouldn't let me in her house. My mother was a drunk for years, you know. How come her son, all of a sudden, he starts drinking, you can't trust the guy in the house, he'll rip you off, you know. Well, that's the way it was, you know. I didn't work much, so it was hard to get money. So if you had anything of value, I took it, you know. That's just the way it was. But, you know, I started running around with these guys, and I found something that the perfect combination of drinking and running around with these guys, you know, it was like, it wasn't that I wasn't getting love at home, but it was the acceptance I got from these guys to be part of the gang, you know, whatever it was. It wasn't a gang, we were just all partners, you know. And for those guys to accept me, I would have done anything. Now, if we were out fighting somebody, I'd go grab a tire iron or something and start beating some guy or run and hit the biggest guy so they'd say, hey, did you see what Bob did to that guy, you know. And it was important that I always did a little bit more than the next guy. So, you know, I'd let them know that I was in and I was game, you know. If somebody'd steal a black and white TV, I'd go try to take a color TV, you know. But what I'm trying to tell you is that it was so important for these guys to accept me, and the acceptance that I got from them meant so much to me that I would have done anything, you know. And for a person before that, when I was younger, I just wanted to grow up and be a good person and a good human being and not do all these things. All of those values that I had when I was younger, they slowly just kind of dwindled away. You know, and it was from the drinking and the combination of using drugs. And any way that Bob made me to be eventually just faded away. And I can tell you that I started doing a lot of weird things to impress these friends of mine, and pretty soon these friends weren't even around. And I started going to jail for 5 days and 10 days at a time. I've been arrested a couple times for defrauding an innkeeper, which is stealing a hamburger. Have you ever heard of anybody getting arrested for stealing a hamburger? Of course, when you get down to jail, you know, you tell the guys in the cell, well, you know, that you just got busted for an armed robbery or something, you know. You want to, and, you know, I hate to say it, but I was arrested for another time for stealing a shrimp dinner, you know. You know, I've always, yeah, I've been sober a long time in AA, and I'll tell you, I've never missed a meal since I've been there either, you know. Thank God, you know. But, you know, like I said, I never had any money, and I guess I'd just be out there having fun and getting loaded until I got hungry and go steal something. But anyway, those are the stupid things I used to do, and I would do small things like that, and I'd start going to jail. One night I was at my house, and my wife, Gloria, came by and knocked on the door, and I was in there. And at the time, I'd been running around with these, you know, shortly before that, I'd been running around with all my righteous partners. Well, one night, we got stopped by the narcotic officers in Long Beach, and one of my friends broke a man, and they shot him in the back with a .357 Magnum. He didn't die, he just got shot. And but anyway, I'll show you how much the laws have changed. That was in December of 1959. All we have is a couple of joints, you know. Now I guess they give you a traffic ticket or something for if you're holding weed or something. But in fact, they didn't even find any evidence on us. One of the guys who was driving ate the joints. And when we got down to the police station, the police had some more joints. So they can play the same game too, you know. But as it turned out, my friends had been arrested before. And I had been out dating all these girls before, so I had a clean record. And they were all sent to youth authority, sent up to Tracy and all that, which was prison. And I was given 3 years probation. And in this time, I quit drinking and quit using any drugs. And I was just there with my mother one night. And Gloria came by and knocked on the door and said she had just left her husband and split up from him. And we had been friends for many, many years, and we began to laugh and talk that night. And I told her, you know, she said, "I heard you weren't married anymore." And I said, "Oh yeah, I, you know, gave all that up." And we went out that night and started riding around together and drinking. And she knew somewhere we could go get some drugs. And by that time, I had already quit using drugs because my friends were all gone. And you know, anyway, to make a long story short, I found myself night after night with a girl that I always wanted to be with since I was real young, and we were both drinking and getting loaded together, and we just started having a good time, you know. And it didn't make any difference whether we had any money, whether we were drinking wine or if we had a lot of dope or didn't have any or whatever, you know. And we'd just take a ride down Pacific Coast Highway over to Hermosa Beach and to the lighthouse or something, and just sleep on the tables over there for a while and drink a couple of bottles of Trip and Hydrate to get you a little tired, but you know. But this is kind of the way we lived. And like she said, we went together for about 5 months, and actually the way we decided to get married, we'd been drinking and taking a lot of Benzedrine and stuff for days, and we had ran out of weed and didn't have any money to buy any booze. And it was like 4 or 5 o'clock one morning. We were just coming down, and we were just desperate. And that's when we decided, hey, maybe we should get married. You know, you know how you get all panicked out, you know. So by this time I didn't work, and this man had died and left his fishing pole and his will to me, and so that's all I had of value. So I took it down and hawked it, and we got our marriage license, and we got married, you know. And that's the way it started. And she had this child from another marriage, and I can tell you that we had, we were married 10 years before we got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now in that 10 years, I can tell you that it was just a pure, pure living hell. It was a life of going out and turning gas meters on, lying to landlords and staying there for a month or 2 months or 3 months, as long as you could stall them off, telling them you had a check coming in the mail, maybe going to work and working for a while, getting hurt on a job. A lot of times I'd try to stay sober. Usually I became a periodic drunk to where I would drink until I was totally out of control, and my cycle usually ended up in the Los Angeles County Jail. And once I got in jail, I would realize by this time we had a couple of children, and I would realize that, hey, I got to get it together, and I'm not living the way I really want to live. And when I come out of jail, I'm not going to hang around with the guys, and I'm not going to drink, and I'm not going to take anything. And I'd come out of jail, and I'd do real good, you know. Maybe we'd been living on welfare or whatever, you know. I didn't know what it was to buy my children clothes. I never knew what it was. Now that I look back, I don't think I ever bought my children any clothes until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And like I say, we were married for 10 years. I would come out and I'd stay sober for as long as I could. I'd get a job. I was always a real good worker. When I wasn't drinking and I was sober, I was a real nice guy. Everybody liked me. You know, they think, oh, you know, look at, we have people now that know us. They say, I just can't imagine you getting mad, Bob, you know. Well, you know, at the end of my drinking, I became so violent, I was in a fight all the time. I always had a black eye, I was always obnoxious. Because what I'd do, I'd stay sober as long as I could until I couldn't stay sober anymore. And maybe I'd get the job, and we'd do real good. I'd start getting our little family back together, and, you know, I'd start working overtime, have money in the pocket, start buying a little bit of furniture, maybe buy a little used car, and things were going good, you know. So I'd have this money in my pocket, and it just, everything seemed so empty. It seemed, you know, you normally clean the house so much and mow the yard outside. You know, everything was perfect, you know. And that's the way it was. When I wasn't drinking, I didn't do anything wrong. And that's just, it's just the way it was. But once I started drinking, it was just totally the opposite. Just like it says in the big book about the Dr. Jekyll and Hyde, that fits me to a T. Because once I started drinking, once I started taking a Valium or smoking any weed or whatever, it was all over. Because then I started conning myself. And I started, you know, I thought I was fooling everybody else and all I was doing was conning myself. Once I started doing something, I was totally out of control. And anyway, you know, I know what it is to get up and get out of bed in the middle of the night. Maybe we had just a couple of friends over that brought just a six-pack of beer, and they'd say, hey, Bob, you'll be, you know, I remember one of my best friends, and he'd come over and he just drank beer, maybe smoked a little weed. And he'd say, hey, just drink beer and smoke a little weed. And he says, leave those Reds alone, you know, and you'll be okay, you know. And I'd say, yeah, yeah. And right after they left, I remember that one night after we got in bed, I snuck out of bed. I had to go and start running. You know, I like to call it the call of the wild. Because, you know, once you start thinking, man, I'm going to go get loaded, you're going to do it. I remember one time we were doing real good. You know, had all the little kids, and it was a summer day, and the kids were out playing with the sprinkler and all this stuff. And I was mowing the lawn, and I started thinking about it. And as it turned out, I guess my wife came out there an hour later or something, and the lawnmower was sitting there, and I didn't come back for a week, you know. And I was in a bathing suit, mowing the lawn. When I came back, I had new shoes, a new sport coat, everything, you know. That's just the way it is. But that's the way we operate, you know. I wanted to get loaded, and I wanted to run. And once that starts hitting me, you know. And I can tell you that I did that time after time. And once I started running the cycle, it just meant whatever I may do when I was out there. Like I said, I'd steal and rob and cheat. I can briefly tell you real quick that I've been arrested for all kinds of various offenses, from driving under the influence to armed robbery to burglaries, whatever. Because once I started doing my deal, it was all over. Like I say, I became a very violent person. I've hurt a lot of people. When I was drinking, totally the opposite. I was just like an animal, just crazy. People just had to stop me because I was totally out of control. And that's what alcohol did for me. And that's what alcohol did for my life. And I can tell you that the last 5 years of my drinking, 2 years of that time, my wife and I ran and lived on Skid Row. We went into a bar one day in Long Beach, and the bartender said, hey, the police were in here looking for you, and I knew I'd pulled some burglaries and stuff and that they were going to bust me, and I said, we got to leave town, and that's how we left. And as it turned out, we were gone for 2 years. And the other 3 years of that 5 years, I was in the Los Angeles County Jail for various offenses and from second-degree robberies or whatever. And I can tell you that I was 29 years old, and I was in the old county jail, and it was one night, a guy yelled out in the middle of the night, and they took this guy away on a gurney, and he yelled out and everything, and everybody was yelling, and in jail, it got real noisy, and then after it got real quiet, something happened to me that night that I could see my whole life for what it really was. I was 29 years old, and I just didn't want to be Bob anymore. And I thought if I could be like the dumbest idiot in the world, I'd be better off than being me. And as it turned out, a man from the probation department came to interview me to find out what he was going to recommend to the judge, whether they were going to send me to prison or give me probation or what. And I told him that that I was an alcoholic and that if I was given probation that I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I had been to AA for a short time a few years before, and I think I had a drunk driving or something, and my wife and I both went to some AA meetings out in Southgate. Somewhere where somebody in her family worked or something, they were in AA, but they told us, and so we went out there, and I can remember going to meetings out there, and we always took Valium, you know. I'd always take a couple of Valium because I thought, God, they might call on me to talk or something. I don't want to be nervous, you know, at the meeting. So, you know, I always popped a couple of Valium, and they talked about being sober, and I thought they were just talking about drinking. You know, we always smoked a lot of weed. I mean, my hands were always just brown on the fingers, you know. I mean, and we'd always smoke a can or two a week of weed, you know. And a lot of times we'd go to the meetings and we'd come home, and maybe it would be a night we wouldn't go to the meeting. Nice summer night, the ice cream truck would go by and we'd smoke a couple of joints and go out and get a hot fudge sundae and sit on the porch. And after I'd leave, and I'd say, man, isn't this sobriety fantastic? Yeah, I thought we were sober. I don't know if anybody's in this audience is smoking weed, but or drinking, or, you know, taking any pills or whatever, but sobriety means sobriety, you know, that means sober. And I'm glad I did all those things, because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew I couldn't do anything. And I knew that I was my worst enemy. And I knew that all the time I thought I'd been conning all the people on the street, I'd just been conning myself. I'd been cheating myself out of life. And anyway, as it turned out, I got back to my cell, and after talking to that man, and I heard myself telling this man that I was an alcoholic, and I knew it without a doubt. And that night something happened to me, and I knew I was an alcoholic, and I really wanted to do something. And I'd been married 10 years to my wife, and we always drank together, and I thought, you know, maybe I'm going to have to let her go or whatever. And as it turned out, I was sent to a road camp that I had served a year in up in Newhall and Saugus up in Soledad Canyon. I had served a year in this camp, and 5 years later I returned to the same camp, the same Los Angeles sheriff's officers that worked in there. There was like four or five of them, four or five deputies and a sergeant working there. They were all still there, the same ones that when I left. And they said, hey, welcome back, Bob, you know. And I was a cook for these officers, and I used to be the baker there for this road camp, and I ended up back with my same job. 5 years had gone by. I had been out for 5 years on the street. I hadn't come out and really got it together, really bought a home or done anything nice like that. All I had done is just ripped and roared and run around the streets and just totally out of control. And anyway, I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in there, my mother would come up and she had my children. My wife was still on the streets, and my mother would tell me, well, you know, Gloria's out robbing prices with a couple of your buddies, and I thought, God, I'm going to have to cut her loose, you know. But I knew more than anything that I had to get something going for myself. And then it wasn't long before my mother came another Sunday, and she said that my wife was in the Harbor General Hospital and that she was dying. And I knew that her liver was real bad, and they said that if she ever got sick again, she'd die. And one day I was serving food in the mess hall there, and this other black friend of mine came, and I just started bawling like a baby, and he followed me outside, and I just cried to him, and I said, I can't believe my life, you know, that I'm in here, and my children are somewhere else, and my wife's dying. And it was just, our whole life was just like a nightmare. It was just unreal, you know. It wasn't long after that I started, I got a letter from my wife, and usually when I was in jail, we never corresponded with each other. It was just easier for me not to know what she was doing on the street, and she didn't need to worry about me in there. And it was just easier for us. Anyway, I got this letter that she was getting better, and that she was going to go to this woman's recovery house, or she had got there. And God, I wrote her back, and I says, God, I've been a member of AA for a long time. You know, I wanted to know who had the most sobriety. But You know, my wife and I, we've known each other since we were little kids, and, you know, I knew everything about her, and I was just glad that my wife was still alive. And like my wife said, you know, we've, as alcoholics, we've done everything humanly possible to hurt each other, you know, any way you could think of, and that's all been forgiven, and we've gone on with our lives, and I can tell you, man, we got a fantastic life. I'm so grateful for the life I have. I don't know of anybody I could possibly think of that could have a life that I have. Not that my life doesn't have pain or anything, but to be given the life that I have today to be able to live. And I just have to know that that's the life that God really gave me to live. And I could have had that from the very beginning, but I was an alcoholic, you know. But for the grace of God, I found Alcoholics Anonymous. There's new people that are in this room tonight, you know, and you're wondering what you're doing here and what it's all about. I can remember when I was first sober and I got out of jail and I was riding a bus, you know, and had a pair of tennis shoes and I didn't have any money and I had to go down to welfare and get money for a room and riding the bus back and forth and going to meetings, and I just thought, hey, I'll be doing this 10 years from now, you know. And that's the way I thought it was going to be. But we don't know what God's plan is for us, and we have to start at the beginning, you know. And life is so, so beautiful. It really is. My wife and I have had so much pain since we've been sober, but we've had so much joy, too. We're able to live life on life's terms, you know, and it's beautiful, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life. We live a different way of life here. When I came out, I started telling my wife, when I got out of jail, I went down to this woman's recovery house where my wife was, and just went by to see her. I didn't know whether we were going to be back together or not. We hadn't, neither one of us had even thought about that or even made that decision. I just wanted to see her. And I went and knocked on this door at this woman's recovery house, and this lady asked me to step in, and I stood there waiting for my wife. She says, wait, I'll go get her. And I stood there in this room, and my wife came walking through, and I can tell you, it was good to see her, and it was good to see her alive. And she was sober, and I was sober. And I can tell you, the way we lived, everything was bad. Everything was hard. Everything hurt. Everywhere you sit down, it hurt. It was hard. That's the way we live. There was no toilet paper with flowers on it or pretty drapes. My wife, I had to walk down the hall so she could go to the bathroom so some other man didn't grab her. I'm talking about the hallway down the hall in the Wino Motel deal where you're living. That's the way we live. Everything was bloody and sick and sores. That's the way we live. Look at us today. We don't live that way. My wife and I have been sober for 22 years. And we came, I came out of jail and I, you know, started going to meetings with these women in this woman's recovery house, riding around with them. I was a guy that lifted weights, went to the Y and was driving iron and all this in jail, and found myself all scrunched up in the back seat of this car, you know. And I'd ride on the freeways down by Torrance and all that, and with all these women, and I'd think, hey, what's it all about? You know, what's going to happen, you know? And eventually we got this little apartment, and we decided we'd go back together. And it was just a little apartment with a pull-down bed, you know. We had one of those Murphy beds. And God, and then one of the girls said, you'll have to have a phone. And she said, we got to get a phone. And I was real panicked out because it was going to be $4.85 a month. I said, well, we won't be able to afford it. And we got five phones, you know. But, you know, if you're new, man, it's a hell of a deal, man. So many things. We just started growing and growing, and people would come over and we'd play cards and we'd eat cookies and stuff, you know, stuff we'd never done before, and laughed and just went to more meetings. And like I said, I rode the bus, and pretty soon the time came up for me to get my driver's license. I'd had it taken away, and by that time I was able to afford insurance to be able to get my license, and I was honest, and I didn't drive all that time. And, you know, we had a little car that somebody had sold us for $50, and I never drove that car. But I had to start getting honest with myself. And this is the honesty that I'm talking about. If you were anything like me, I was the kind of guy that would go in the supermarket and always steal something, you know. And I had to quit doing things like that. I always was aware of when there was a cop around. And, you know, by not doing that and not driving that car, not stealing, pretty soon didn't make any difference if there was a cop around or not. You know, I realized I wasn't doing anything wrong, and I had lost that fear, and I realized, hey, that cop's just another human being. You know, he's not a cop. He's not going to bother me. And, my first sponsor was a painter, and I worked at this coffee shop as a cook, and I'd be in there. I can remember I worked from 8 to 4 at night on Friday and Saturday night. My wife would come in after 10 o'clock with all these AAs, and they'd all wave at me, and I'd be in the kitchen, and I'd be back there full of self-pity and thinking, man, I'm here working. I'll be doing this forever. I don't have to ride the bus anymore. But, she started a meeting at 1 o'clock in the morning, so she could stay up long enough, pick me up at 4 in the morning, And I can't believe that she had this meeting going at 1 o'clock in the morning. It was over in the ghetto, too, But, it worked, and it kept her sober. But anyway, our life has just gone on and on. And, through all of this, she had a violation from her probation, and we were just beginning to tap in with the AAs, and our life was getting good, and the time came for her to go down to the court. She was on a year suspended sentence, and she had had, was arrested with all these guys that were pulling these robberies. And anyway, they had violated her probation, so she had to go back to court. And so I went down to the courtroom with her this one day, and I thought, well, this is going to be the end of it. She'll probably go to jail, and I'll be out cheating on her or whatever. I didn't know. I was sober, and I didn't know what I was going to do, And as it turned out that day, we went up to the court, and she went up in front of the judge, and he looked down at a bunch of papers, and he looked up at my wife, and, it was all in his hands that day. And he looked at my wife, and he said, I think you've had some kind of a change in your life. He said, I have several letters here from people in Alcoholics Anonymous that said that you're really trying to stay sober, and you're trying to do something with your life. And he said, I'm going to reinstate your probation. And that day, my wife and I, we ran out of the courtroom in Long Beach and Ocean Boulevard like two little kids, knowing that everything was going to be okay. And I can tell you that whatever's coming down, it's going to be okay. Whatever heavy deal you got, if you got a court deal, or, if you cheated or robbed or whatever the circumstances is, if you stay sober and you stay with the AA people, everything's going to be okay. It wasn't long before I realized when I was sober that I could do anything that I wanted to if I wanted to make the effort for it. And, my first sponsor was a painter, and one day he asked me if I'd like to help him paint, and I worked for him for about 90 days painting, and he didn't have any more work, so I went back and got a civil service job. Not painting, but as a cook. I went to Long Beach General Hospital, and I told them I was a cook. I'd been working for the county cooking for years for 50 cents a day in jail, But they didn't seem to take that under consideration. They didn't even want to hire me, but they hired me on a temporary probationary deal. And I can tell you, when I was 2 years sober, that I was a pot washer at the Long Beach General Hospital in Long Beach, and that's how I started out. They wouldn't let me start cooking, but I started washing pots. And, I was 2 years sober. I was making about $85 a week. My wife was working on the graveyard shift at Norm's Restaurant as a waitress. We had our children back, and things were hard. They weren't easy. We were trying to go to meetings. We were taking care of our kids. We were working. I was trying to do a little painting on the side. One afternoon I came in. My wife was asleep on the bed. And I busted in all happy, and I said, because I had started doing this painting. I was crooking, and by this time I had made a crook at this, and I was a permanent employee for the civil service. I had a good, solid job, but we never had much money. And I come running in, I had like a couple $100. I said, hey, the little old lady across the street gave me $200 to start painting this other house, and we figured it out. I had like a month's work painting besides my regular job. And that day I laid on the bed with my wife, and we were laying there looking up at the ceiling. I felt like I was high on acid or something. And, you know, and she said, you know, we were just talking about the miracles of how things happen. We just keep going on. And she said, hey, I think God wants you to be a painter. And that day I made a decision to quit a supposedly secure job, a civil service job. I quit it and went into business for myself with the little knowledge that I had of painting. And it wasn't long that I had all the work I could handle. I started, you know, having a guy in the program help me. And, you know, and it was because I was honest. I did whatever I told the people I'd do. Honesty for a painter means painting behind the toilet, you know. Yeah. Every time I paint the bathroom, I'd be ready to leave, and I'd say, God, I better paint behind the toilet. They might look, you know. And I'd always do it, and that was it. But I began to realize, and I put what I found in AA, the principles, to start doing right with people. And it's just, I could see the rewards coming back. The more I did good for people and helped people, the more they came to me. And that's been that way. And, you know, eventually I would go to meetings and there'd be guys who were like contractors and they'd say, hey, you need a license. You're doing the illegal. And I'm like, ooh, God, don't tell me that, you know. And I'm out painting and I'd see cars go by with emblems like, you know, county emblems or state emblems. And I thought, man, they're going to bust me, you know, and it'll be all over. So eventually I went down and I got my... I had to go a lot of times to school. I'd go to school. It was on my home group night, and I'd always try to miss school to go to my home group. And my sponsor, I'd come in the meeting and say, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be at school. I said, man, I need a meeting, you know. Anyway, it took me a long time, and eventually I finished the course, and I went and took my state contractor's test, and I got my state contractor's for a painter. And, you know, it just changed my life financially. But just so many things have happened to my life through Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 1 year sober. My mother had already quit drinking for about 3 months just from the example of my wife and I. And she came to my 1 year birthday party, and at that time she said she wanted to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she asked my wife to be her sponsor. And they were riding around buying new curtains for her house, and everything was just beautiful. And I was, you know, just so happy. And, you know, after about a year and a half, my mother, I know it's time to quit, but I just got a few more minutes. There are a few things I have to tell you that, anyway, after about a year and a half, my mother, she says, Bob, she said, I got to go to the doctor. She said, I'm just so nervous. And she was nervous at the meeting. She was afraid they were going to call on her to share, and she didn't want to have to talk. And she said, I'm going to go to the doctor. And I said, well, you better not go to the doctor. All we're going to do is give you some pills. And she said, oh, Bob, you're the one that had the problem with the pills. I've never had any trouble with that. And I said, well, you better tell them you're an alcoholic. Well, she went to the meetings, and she went to the doctor, and she didn't tell him she was an alcoholic. And eventually they started giving her pills. And pretty soon she was on, like, Librium and Valium. They were giving her Stelazine and then Sorazine. And, you know, it was just ridiculous. I mean, she quit going to meetings, and one Saturday I went over to see her to try to pep her up a little bit, and I went over there, and my mother was laying, and she said, turn the television off. I can't stand it. It's so loud. And I looked, and it wasn't on, and my mother, like, lost her mind. And it was really a sad thing for somebody to drink all those years and come and find Alcoholics Anonymous and have that happen. It was terrible. And I went home, and I told my wife, and it was really sad. And we took her to the psychiatric ward at Long Beach Memorial Hospital, and she was there for a long time. And they took her off those pills and gave her some other pills, and she never got any better. And she was in there for a long time, and we thought they were probably going to put her in Camarillo or something like that. And one day my wife says, hey, I know, that's what we'll do with your mother. Let's go take her out of there and take her to a woman's recovery house. And we did that. And those women with a week sobriety or a month or whatever, they loved my mother back to being well. And my mother's sober today, and she's like 82 years old. And, you know, so... Alcoholics Anonymous just keeps on working, you know. It just keeps on going. All of my children, I got to tell you briefly, have come. My daughter was the youngest of the bunch, and she was just beautiful. We did every. She had all of the benefits of our sobriety, our daughter. I started doing good. We sent her to church schools and, you know, tried to put her through all the best, you know, protective, you know, to watch that she'll be in the right situation. She was a cheerleader and sent her to a modeling deal. She won an award for that. I mean, she's just a beautiful girl. And I can tell you that she ended up, one day we were in Las Vegas, and my mother called and they had taken her. She had like OD'd and her heart stopped on cocaine, and she started using drugs. And anyway, she came back. I had to call one of the guys I sponsored, went to the hospital and stood there at the bedside until we could get back. And that began a life, a whole new life for us. And my son ran away when he was 13 years old. My son was a homosexual, and he started running on the streets, and we were all sober, and we tried to do what we could. And when my wife talked about being up night after night, she was up night after night, worried about where her boy was, because we didn't know for a long time. And anyway, he was gone until he was about 20, 22, whatever it was, years old. And one day he called and said he needed some money to get out of town, and somehow he started talking with his mom, and she said, why don't you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? And we always thought our son was so sick that and had so many problems that he'd never get what we had. That, and, you know, for somehow God moved, and he listened, and he was willing, and he went to a place down in Dana Point, and he stayed there and for 30 days, and then he found out about another recovery place in Hollywood where there was a lot of gays and homosexuals, and he wanted to go there, and that's where his sobriety started. And I can tell you that our son, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, we got to really know our boy, and he was a good, loving boy. He was a fantastic member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We used to show up at a meeting way out in Pasadena or something, our boy would be sitting there. He didn't even know we were coming to nothing. He was just all over. He was involved in conventions. He had done decorations for 2 years for Southern California Convention. He was a fantastic member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And anyway, he got so sick, and he had told us he was HIV positive, and we just thought, well, you know, I mean, we didn't know that much. I mean, we knew that it would eventually, you know, this was like years ago. We just thought, well, be careful. You know, we don't want you to get AIDS. You know, I mean, we're sober. And he told us this, and we didn't realize it. And, but eventually, we moved to Palm Springs out there in the desert, and he called and said that he needed to quit his job. He couldn't work, and he tried to get an apartment out there, and eventually he came, and we said, you better live with us. And anyway, he showed my wife and I what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about, even though we were very involved, and his dedication was so strong and so pure that it just makes me want to just be the best member I can, you know, because Alcoholics Anonymous gave him his life. One day when he was on his deathbed there, he said that life was real hard until he found Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, he went to a place where he said he found those guys up there to talk. It was a perfect deal. We're all given just what we need. We're all here just at the right time, you know. And I've been given so much. I had the opportunity to know my son. You know, December 2nd at 10 after 4 in the morning, I walked into his room and he was gone. He was gone. His sister was lying in the bed next to him. I woke her up. She says, you're kidding. I said, no, he's gone. He's not coming back. But he died a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And about a week before that, we had a meeting, and he said, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And his only wish, that night, there was about 8 of us in there, a couple of his homosexual friends, a couple people from West Covina had come that had been sober like 30 years, a couple of local people, we're all in AA, and he asked, he said, all I ask, he said, I'd like you all to sign my book and put it in my coffin, and we did that, you know. But he lived, and he lived life full, and he said, I've had a good life, but you know, we need to go on living, whatever our life is and whatever the span is. I need today to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to stay sober. I need to carry the message, to share what I have to help another person, if possible. You know, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, I have today what I always wanted to be. I wanted to be a good man, a good father, and a good husband. And thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous and you people and the principles I've found here, I can be that person. Thank you.